And if we were to total all of the dollars that any one person is bringing in, any one organization is bringing in month over month, year over year, we have one client that was able to grow their program. And because of their monthly giving program, they reached $1 million of online fundraising for the first time last year.
Welcome to Giving Voices, stories told by and about philanthropists, where philanthropists and their advisors tell stories about how they influenced, experienced, and led through times of transition, where we celebrate and learn from that transition, that period where decisions are made, and where we always find a meaningful way to connect and foster community. I'm your host, Stephanie Borsari, and now for today's show. Voices community. So, you know how sometimes you just meet somebody and there's kind of an instantaneous connection? That's how it felt when I met today's guest, Emily Goodstein. Eternal gratitude to our mutual friend, the brilliant and thoughtful Gray Joyce, for making the introduction. Hello, Emily. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Stephanie, I'm so happy to be here. Thanks for inviting me. And major shout out to Gray for making this connection.
Well, let's keep going on the Gray theme, because I mentioned to you just briefly that I had to go back to the email he sent that put us together, because I was just having a hard time encapsulating all of the wonderful things in your background, especially since I'm going to ask you to introduce a little bit of yourself. So I went back to the email, and this is what he said. I'd like to make a quick intro between two brilliant and lovely and wonderful human beings, noting particularly that Emily has built a beautiful business and network as founder CEO of Greater Good Strategy, serving nonprofit organizations from a strategic and marketing perspective. And as soon as I saw that, which I was going back to for inspiration, I said, well, right there, there's the intro. So hello, brilliant and wonderful and lovely Emily Goodstein. Thank you for joining me again. And let's let you speak for yourself. Please tell us the story of Greater Good Strategy. What is it? How did it start?
Wow. it's kind of a fun story. Most of all, I just wish that Gray was here hanging out with us. So next time we do this, we'll invite him. The story of Greater Good Strategy is that I think I always sort of knew in the back of my head that I wanted to work for myself and start my own business. So when I was little, I think I was in elementary school or middle school, I had a business selling beads that I would make at like farmers markets. It was called M's Gems. Which was a little play on my initials, EG. And that was like the beginning of my dipping my toe into the world of entrepreneurship. My parents were very supportive of that. And then fast forward a few years, I'm not going to say how many years, but a few years, I found myself working in the nonprofit technology space, helping nonprofit organizations raise money online. And I really had like a front row seat at any one time, upwards of 70 different nonprofits to see their structure and how they were funded and how they marketed and fundraised and staffed and what worked and what didn't work and what was challenging and successful. I left that role and I had a job that I didn't love for a short period of time. And it was really what prompted me to go out on my own. And that was the beginning of really formally working for myself. That was almost 10 years ago. And then after being in that sort of world of solopreneurship for a period of time, I realized that in order to really help our clients move the needle on a project, I was ending up making a lot of referrals to other consultants. So I could sort of stick with, I could do a handful of things, and I think I can do a million things. I could do a handful of things well. And then I needed to refer to a graphic designer or to an email production specialist or a web developer, or you name it, one of many, many other skill sets. And it took a lot for a project to go from start to finish for each client. And at the same time, so that was the client experience. And I was also thinking sort of personally, if I ever wanted to take a big chunk of time off, perhaps to like get married or maybe have a baby, I would have to put a whole bunch of projects on hold. And in order to avoid that, maybe I would want to work with a bigger team. So that the concept of Greater Good was developed sort of 6 years ago, and then we launched 5 years ago in November. So we just celebrated our 5-year anniversary in November of 23, which was very exciting.
Congratulations. And, that's a huge, huge milestone. That's really very
thank
good.
You. I used to sell, when I first quit the full-time job and I first went out on my own, I celebrated every month that I could pay my rent.
Smart.
Myself. And now, not only is that happening, but we have a handful of full-time folks on our team. And then we have the total greater strategy team is 60 people, most of whom work on a project basis. And I can talk all about why I love that model. I still feel so lucky that this is my job. I still feel so lucky that the folks that I get to work with every day show up and want to give their energy and brain power to the causes that we support. And I feel really lucky.
That's awesome. Thank you for sharing that. I knew I wasn't going to do that background justice, especially the little nugget about your being a solopreneur all the way back in elementary school.
Yep.
You and I have talked before about one of the criticisms in the social sector is that it's very siloed, right? And that's not something that will be a foreign concept for anybody listening in today, where the proverbial charities sit on one side and the philanthropy entities sit on the other. And there are lots and lots of people who are actively working to close that gap and to bring entities together and to enhance the collaboration and the cooperation, the relationship between and among the sides or the aisles. And so I'm observing one of the things that you've pointed out through what you've just described is that you sit right there in the intersection of both sides, if you will, because your work is ultimately meant to bring the sides together. Although most of your clients, I know, are nonprofits and you work with them on fundraising and marketing, you must also understand the philanthropic audience whose attention your clients seek. So again, giving voices stories told by and about philanthropists, what can you share with us about your experience in working with the philanthropists as you serve a majority nonprofit base?
Well, first, I don't know if it's helpful, but I'm going to share a little bit more about kind of when organizations hire us so folks can get a better feel of sort of
Perfect.
how we sit at that intersection. And then we can talk about what our work is like with folks on the philanthropy side. So most greater strategy clients are 501c3 nonprofit organizations. 90% of our clients are nonprofits that are looking to raise money from individual donors, from individuals that can make a major gift, folks that are maybe lower dollar individual donors that are giving online, and then also that have relationships, year-over-year relationships with larger institutions that are making philanthropic gifts on that front. So when we get involved, it's often because an organization will say to us, you know, our email fundraising is not performing as well as we'd hoped. Or, you know, we're trying to reach a whole new audience and we're having trouble getting to them. We don't know how to get to them. Or we just launched this new program and we don't know how to market it. Or sometimes I get calls from people and they say, we just got a chunk of earmarked funding for X, Y, and Z. Can you help us figure out how to do that? We know that there's these six things we need from an agency levers. And it's a great little spot to sit in because we do get a little bit of kind of like broad strokes data on, wow, you know, it seems like a trend. A lot of people are calling about this. There actually are a few foundations in our network where I know when they make their allocation decisions because I start to get phone calls around that time because they often will make capacity building and training related grants. And often people will come to us and say, great, you know, we need your help with training on this, and this when it comes to digital or something like that. So I think the place where these two kind of pieces intersect is I do think, as you said, Stephanie, that often folks think that it's like two very siloed communities. And I think another silo that sometimes exists is there's a unfortunately a big separation between the people that are doing the fundraising for large numbers of lower dollar donors, like an online grassroots campaign, and the folks that are doing fundraising from a smaller number of higher capacity donors, whether it be an individual or a foundation. And at the end of the day, and our team hears me say this all the time, I am of the mindset, yes, maybe if someone has a history of making larger gifts and they want to get more information, and maybe they're going to ask more questions about your financials or they have a particular area of interest, it makes sense, of course, to maintain a relationship in a different way. But at the end of the day, whenever someone's making a gift, it's going to be meaningful to them. It's if it has a lot of zeros on it or only one zero or no zeros on it, it's still a meaningful gift. And the person that's giving $30 or $3 million probably still wants to know what's the impact that these dollars will go toward. How are you moving the needle on XYZ problem? Do I like the way your organization approaches this? Thanks for
I
keeping
love
attention.
that you're saying this because I quite literally yesterday just had a conversation with somebody, and I've been having this conversation repeatedly about who gets to own the word philanthropist and why do we demean or think less of donors who are smaller donors? There's so much often capacity. If you're thinking purely dollars and purely assets, there can be so much capacity. And at the end of the day, as you say, doesn't it just matter that people are giving? So I know that's not where you are going, but I just had to point that out, like, because it's one of the things I'm passionate about right now is how people give and who gets to be called a philanthropist as they do
Totally.
so.
I mean, not to talk about myself too much, Stephanie, but my family is not, we are not major donors anywhere. We are two full-time mid-career professionals with a three-year-old, a very expensive city. But there have been times in our philanthropic past where we just finished our will and estate plans, and we were able to identify a handful of organizations we wanted to be named in there. And that felt very special and very significant. And those organizations have to know that my estate is not going to build a new building for them. But at the end of the day, at age 40, I've made a decision that hopefully in another 100 years, or something, that's a long time. Hopefully in a long time, a portion of our estate to these organizations that we really want to help thrive in a very for the long in the long run.
Yes, and you really had to reflect on that and make those decisions. And you had to find out about those organizations in some way. And they had to have done something that made meaning for you.
Totally. They did. I mean, the folks did a really good job. I actually posted about it on Instagram, and a handful of the organizations said, "Hey, I'm the comms person for so and so organization. I just wanted to connect you with our planned giving person. She's going to send you a note. Her name is blah, blah, blah. We're so excited to welcome you into our community of so." Like, it was, people were really wonderful about it. And I don't think we would have popped up in any significant wealth screen, but I was still proud of the fact that even from our little corner of the world, we could still make a little contribution from a philanthropic perspective. So yes, I do feel strongly that a person who's going to click donate now and maybe put their credit card number in and make a gift, perhaps it's not going to move, it's not going to be a whole person's salary, but it's still meaningful for that person. And also, who knows where that's going to go? Whether or not it's significant for the organization, it's significant for the person to do that. The other thing we know in, I forget what the year was, but it's in the last 5 years, there was a great chunk of research that came out. I think the organization, the press release that I read was from CLASI, and they talked about the fact that sustaining donors, so monthly donors that just do a set it and forget it for a small, like usually a low dollar monthly gift, is the number one most fastest growing philanthropic segment when it comes to grassroots fundraising. And if we were to total all of the dollars that any one person is bringing in, any one organization is bringing in month over month, year over year, we have one client that was able to grow their program. And because of their monthly giving program, they reached $1 million of online fundraising for the first time last year. A million
That's
dollars.
amazing. That's $1 million coming from people who would not otherwise be categorized as philanthropists.
Totally. If I saw $1 million on the sidewalk, I'd stop and pick it up. So I think that that really is, that's going to change that organization, the capacity of that organization. Obviously, it took a ton of work on their part to do that. It didn't just happen. But I do think that I love that monthly giving stat because I think it was something like 400% year over year growth in that place and continued for the last 5 years. It's the place that we continue to be the number one best ROI is from an investment in those monthly lower dollar donors. So I think that's the place where I would say I sit. That's my front row seat, really, with those lower dollar individual donors. But a few other ways that I sort of interact with the philanthropic space, we also have a handful of foundations as clients. So I get to talk to them about how they're allocating dollars. Foundations will often bring greater good strategy in to do professional development and some sort of like tactical assistance or support when it comes to digital space, online giving, marketing online. And then the other piece is that I believe that philanthropists are looking at what organizations are doing online. So if you are a donor, whether you're a program officer at a foundation or you're part of a family office or you have a donor advised fund or something, I'm pretty sure you're reading an organization's emails and their content's probably showing up in social feeds. And maybe you're showing up at their in-person events once in a while and you're looking at how you're listening to how they talk about themselves and what the impact is of the organization. So I would say that I get a lot of different vantage points from this industry, and it's very fun, and it's also imperfect and politicized, and there's a lot of power dynamics, and we're going to get to all that, but I'm lucky that I get to see it from a lot of sides.
Yes, absolutely. And you've just hit on so many things. I mean, you can see me, Emily, but those of you out in radio land cannot. I'm nodding my head sort of vigorously with everything that you're saying. You talk to me a little bit more about what some of the observations that the philanthropists or the philanthropic entities have made with you. Yes, most of them should be, if they're doing the work in my mind, let's just represent this as my opinion. If they're doing the work the right way, they're doing their own work in looking at organizations and not expecting charities to spoon feed them absolutely everything. So,
Totally.
with that opinion having been stated, what are some of the key observations that your work, let's say with your very specific private foundation or philanthropic entities, those handful, how are they informing your work and what are your observations from them about their work?
I love this question because I think that there is a good amount of misinformation is the wrong word, but I think people often, it's the grass is always greener, right? So we look at somebody that is a program officer at a foundation, and folks at nonprofits will often think, oh, that person has the dream job. They just get to give out the money.
Yep.
And the biggest thing I think I see is that those FARC folks are working as hard, if not harder, than some type of nonprofit organizations, and their budgets are finite. Even though they are allocating funds, there's also the same sense of resource scarcity that nonprofit staff experience. And I think depending on the philanthropic entity, sometimes those people, a program officer or someone who's making allocation decisions, doesn't really have control over the mission or topic area that a particular funder wants to go after. And those things can change. And they have to have the conversations to explain, wow,
Right.
this is going to significantly impact
There's
your
layers.
staff. There's
There's
so many
layers. There's the
layers.
donors and the boards, and those are the people who are making the decisions. Certainly, staff members can have influence, but ultimately, it often, most of the time, the decision whether to cut a check or not is out of their own hands.
Really. And there's this weird power dynamic too, right? So here are the folks that often our clients interact with, so a program officer at a foundation, sometimes it's a strange power dynamic because that program officer, yes, has some decision-making power, but not all of it. And they also know about the needs of potentially all the organizations that they want to fund. They're hearing these very ambitious impact projections, and they don't have, as I said, they don't have an unlimited pool of resources, yet they're also kind of being pandered to in some way. They're being wined and dined in certain ways, or they have to imagine that there's always kind of like an ulterior motive when people get in touch with them, which I think is strange just from like a human to human perspective. And I don't think we can look beyond these very serious power dynamics and all of the other societal dynamics that exist, right? So there's a race, class, gender dynamic. There are dynamics at the end of the day. Most of these dollars are still concentrated in a very small percentage of the population who are not really representative of the entire population. And so, to name it, we have these one percenters who are thankfully being philanthropic, which is fantastic that they're doing that work at all. But it becomes sort of strange that it's like a little gatekeepy that at the end of the day, folks that still hold the purse strings are people that perhaps all look very similar, and they don't often have the lived experience that other people might have that are more representative of the larger population. In addition to that, the people that are making the decisions are not the people that can speak firsthand about what it's like to experience homelessness, perhaps, or what it's like to have a parent who has died in labor because of lack of research of maternal health. I mean, there's just, as you said before, Stephanie, there's so many layers. And it's sort of like the access that we have as folks in the philanthropy community to the people who are making these contributions or who have committed to putting a portion of their dollars toward making the world a better place. Those are the people that are like already there, right? But I often think about who are the people that are not doing that? What are all the piles of dollars that those people are sitting on? And how can we convince them to free up some of that money?
Right. Do
So,
you hear your clients say that too? Is there a sense of frustration that you assess coming from those who are doing it?
yeah, totally. I mean, what I hear a lot is I have a grant proposal due literally last week. I had a call with someone and they said, you know, so and so on the call is actually going to be multitasking. We really need to have this conversation today, but we also have this grant proposal that's due tomorrow and we have to do another read through and it has to be, we have to do this other segment or something. Or the organizations that I hear, okay, you know, in that work plan you're creating for us, we need to take weeks off in the middle because we have three grant reports due, and that's going to be an all hands on deck situation to pull those financials. And our staff is only five people, so that's really a very significant chunk of work. So we really take ourselves offline to fulfill those reporting requirements. I don't think reporting requirements are bad. I think it's really important that we're reporting and we're monitoring ROI, and for us to collectively in the community of people that breathe, that want to make the world a better place. I think it's good that we look at how things, what impact is, and we look at ROI and things like that. But to take a 2 weeks off for a staff of five people to have to put in grant reports, like what do the grant reports need? And how can we simplify that so it's not so arduous for staff so that they can continue to fulfill their organization's mission while also fulfilling the needs of a grant, a grantee or grantor?
So this totally tees up one of the questions that you and I just touched on very, very briefly earlier this week. And it was with regard to Exponent Philanthropy's report that they've either released or are getting ready to release. They must have released it. And of course, I couldn't find it after taking all of my notes and thinking this through. So sorry, listeners, that I can't be more specific on what this was. But I will tell you that the topic was, how do you think funders can improve? And it was, I think there are about 450 respondents introduced to the survey by donors. And it was like a handful of donors, private foundations, maybe six or 10. And they identified the grantees. They sent out the survey as created by Exponent, but adjusted so that it was representative of the relationship with their own grantees. And they were literally asking the question, and it's, you know, it's a survey format, but how could funders be? How can they improve? So by and large, all of the funders marked themselves as higher on the scale or more impactful on the scale than the grantees marked them, which I suppose is not a total surprise. But I'll tell you where they landed similarly was whether the foundation has reasonable expectations throughout the grant cycle. So that's actually kind of good. They both landed over 50% in the 60s. The highest place they landed was, we have a strong and positive relationship with the foundation, said the grantees. So that's good. That's nearly 70%. But here's where the grantees gave lower than the grantors believed themselves. And I'm convinced that there's a place that you're seeing this also with greater good strategy. And it has to do, in my mind, with communication. Places like Foundation clearly and consistently communicates its goals and strategies. Just 52% strongly agreed with that. The foundation's decision-making process appears fair and appropriately transparent. Only half of the grantees strongly agreed with that. That the foundation collaborates with the community, with its grantees, and with other funders. All ranked like 55%, we strongly agree with that, or lower. And in fact, the lowest was the thought that the foundation collaborates with other funders. Now, if you were to ask the funders, and they did, Exponent did, all of the funders think or say they are doing much more than, they strongly agree with that statement, much more than 41% of the time. So there's a huge disconnect between what private foundations believe, funders believe they are doing or know that they are doing, and what their grantees think that they're doing. Where do you see that? Can you, how, what does that do to you who sit on both sides and are making these matches and having conversations with both?
The grades are not great. I was very sad when I saw this. Mostly, I mean, sad for really everyone involved because I know, even just the sample size of the human beings that I know that do this work that are on both sides of the funder relationship here, these are people who work really hard, who have fantastic intentions and show up every day and want to make, they want to repair what is broken in the world. No one goes into this work because they want to keep people suffering, right? And so it was sad to see that the industry itself is actually causing continued suffering. So from the speaking on behalf of a funding professional, as you mentioned, Stephanie, briefly, the folks at the funders think that they are doing these things really well, which is the hardest pill to swallow. They think that, you know, they're showing up every day and they're sending these messages out and they're trying to communicate with the nonprofit space. And then here's these like very hardworking development professionals who really just need grant funding to move the needle on the causes that their colleagues are working on and that they feel so passionately about. And they don't feel like they have partners in the funding space. So it's a sad, sad state of affairs over here in this report. And I think you said this, but I want to just reiterate, the thing that got the lowest is the foundation collaborates with other funders.
Yes.
That was the one that got a 41% strongly agree. That was the
And
lowest
yet we
number.
know that's happening. We
Of
absolutely,
course.
there are convenings, there are meetings. Why don't the grantees know it?
Yeah. So I had this conversation last week with one of our foundation clients, and they said, one of their questions was, can we hire Greater Good Plus with our email marketing efforts? We just don't have a staff person on our team to do the content creation that's necessary to keep everyone as informed as they could be and should be with what's going on within our foundation. So then I had to stop and think, okay, the people that we imagine have all the dollars don't have the staff person to do the email writing and the email production for the folks in this funding ecosystem. And it gave me pause, right? That's because in my experience, most of the foundations that we work with don't have unlimited funds, right? They are trying to minimize overhead so that they can allocate as many dollars as they can to the nonprofits that they fund. And this is a sample size of one. This particular conversation, they just sort of said, like, we don't even have the time to think about what to send to what segment of our list.
Right,
And so
right. And who are the constituents and who are your stakeholders?
And I think that in this case, another foundation that we work with is newer, right? I think they're 7 or 8 years old. And a lot of folks in the space that they work in don't even know how to be invited to apply for funding from them, or don't even know that they exist, or that they've expanded into certain issue areas. So I think that part of it has to be because at the end of the day, across the board, resources are scarce. And so I don't work at a foundation, but only from my vantage point, I have to imagine that if the choice was, we're going to hire a full-time person to think about our entire strategy about how we're communicating with all of the people in our ecosystem, or we can fund another staff position at one of our grantees, perhaps the decision is being made to put more money in the budgets of the nonprofits. And this is hard, right? There's a reason why agencies like Greater Good Strategy exist, and that people have their whole career in marketing strategy and communication strategy, because sometimes it's hard to figure out, do we send another email? Does everyone on our list want to get everything we have to share? What do we do about Facebook? Are people still using Pinterest? Well, we
Are
hear
they?
that TikTok is the People do still use Pinterest. Okay, so this, Stephanie, you're so funny. This gets to, you haven't heard me get on my audience soapbox, but I'm just going to talk about it for a second. So in the world of digital, but I think probably in the world of any type of marketing, we can't market everything to everyone. The answer to all those rhetorical questions is no. We cannot just send everything to everyone all the time, because then no one cares. I just watched a little like a story on Instagram. I have a 3-year-old, and the story was about how to make sure your kids don't tune you out. And the story,
We have a
I didn't
whole
know if I,
other podcast on this topic,
That's
everybody.
right. Dr. Becky is going to be your next guest. But the Instagram post was not Dr. Becky, but somebody else who I am trusting as my, parenting expert was saying, if you have to pick and choose how you're disciplining and what you're saying and what behaviors you're correcting, because if you're just like always telling your kid that they're doing something wrong, they're literally going to fully tune everything out that you say. So I think that the same is true from the philanthropic space, that we can't be putting every single message about every single thing that happens in the inboxes and in front of every single person. And from a who else is using Pinterest question, the answer is really who's the audience and what do you want them to do? So if the audience is teachers or parents of younger children or people who are very crafty, those are the main audiences that are gaining content from Pinterest. And those, if you are, I could imagine if you had a curriculum that you wanted to get in the hands of early childhood educators, Pinterest is a great place to be marketing that.
Looked at Pinterest in such a long time, but you're now giving me the like tip to go in there and see. I'm gonna go do that. I'm literally later going to look in my Pinterest account for philanthropy and private foundations and community good and social change and see what comes up. That's an exercise.
This,
Thank you.
I find a lot of stuff on there when it comes to like the education sector. So we have some clients that we work with that do, we've created this particular set of resources to raise awareness about voting, for example. And we want to make sure that it's age appropriate for kindergartners and fifth graders or whatever. And some of the strategy has to do with getting them onto Pinterest because there's such a connection between like the visual representation of a Pinterest board and that in mostly like the early childhood education space happens to be a parallel. But the same we said for any other channel. So we have another client that's specifically trying to reach older teens and folks in their early 20s that are making family planning decisions and having questions about contraceptives. And that particular audience that this client's trying to reach, after doing the research and putting a strategy together, we determined that's a TikTok audience. It's not only a TikTok audience, but that is much more of a TikTok audience than somebody who's retired in her 70s who were looking to become a monthly donor to a cause about literacy or something. So at the end of the day, the answer to a lot of the questions about who should we be sending what to and how often has a lot to do with the who, and then answering the question for yourself, but what do you want them to do? So in the case, putting myself back in the shoes of this foundation that was asking me these questions, they don't have a strategy. So they have there's no strategy to grow their list. So they don't have a plan right now to figure out who else should we be getting in the fold so that they know what we're doing. They have no strategy about once people are on the list, how we talk to them. So what we say to them. There's no strategy that uses multiple channels. So they don't have, like, what's happening on social isn't really in coordination to what's happening over email, to what's happening over snail mail, to what's happening in person. And without a plan, it's hard to determine if you're being successful. And that's not where they've invested. They've invested in their grantees, which makes sense.
It does make sense. But you're also pointing out that from the grantor perspective and the donor perspective, that these channels are being deployed by nonprofits and those engaging in the social change sector. And so it's another place to do the work about research and investigation and doing due diligence, again, without just sitting back and waiting for grantees to submit all of the information. We've talked about so many things that I don't even think we had intended as we were framing out our short time together. So I'm just going to bring us to our last question, Emily, which is, please, what is your wish, your grandest wish for the social sector?
Okay. So I want everyone that's listening to know this. You gave me a heads up about this question, so I had some time to think about it.
Thank you for that.
And my dad always makes fun of me because I always talk about my therapist on whenever I do a podcast interview, but this actually comes from my therapist, who told me that she believes that all the wisdom in the world is contained in the brains of girls that are like 9 to 12. And I actually, I think it's true. I totally agree with that. Having been a girl who was between the ages of 9 and 12, and I just wish that we would listen to girls who are between the ages of 9 and 12, really just listen to girls more, because I think girls are so smart and so often not listened to. And there's so much wisdom contained in their brains and their spirits. And I think all industries could actually benefit from really tuning in to what this population is saying. How do you think all these in charge women get to be so fantastic and know how to rule the world? Because they were these really smart girls. So,
and it takes them a little while because they have to find their voice or look for the permission or the space to deploy that voice. I love that. We're both mothers of daughters and we've connected on that already. And you just helped me make a decision I will share with you later on once this podcast ends. Yep. Good stuff. Good stuff. Emily, this is so fun. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Congratulations on launching the podcast. I'm so honored to be a guest, and major thanks to Gray for connecting us.
Yes. Yes. Awesome. Thank you. Can't wait to talk with you again. Thank you so much for tuning in, Giving Voices community. Check out Greater Good Strategy to see and hear more from my new friend, Emily Goodstein. And I hope you all have a wonderful rest of your day. Bye.
Thank you for listening to Giving Voices and for being part of our community. If you have a story you'd like to share or you'd just like to geek out about philanthropy together, reach out to me at hello@givingvoicespodcast.com. I can't wait to talk with you.